All right. Start again. Assembling facts. That's what it was about. The world watched. Someone wanted the watch to say that the assassination had been inspired by Clatch. Who? Someone had also beheaded Snowy Slopes where he stood and left him deader than six buckets of fish bait. A vision of 71-hour Ahmed's big curved sword presented itself for his attention. So, let's assume that Ahmed was Kufura's servant or bodyguard, and he'd found out... No, how could that work? Who'd tell him? Well, maybe he'd found out somehow, and that meant that he might also know who'd paid the man. Vimes sat back. It was still a mystery, but he'd solve it. He knew he would. He'd assemble the facts, analyze them, look at them from every angle with an open mind, and find out exactly how Lord Rust had organized it. Rank bad hat. He didn't have to sit still for something like that, especially from a man who rhymed house with mice. His eye was caught by the ancient book, General Tacticus. Every kid knew about him. Ankh-Morpork had ruled a huge empire, and a lot of it had been in Clatch, thanks to him. Except there wasn't any thanks for him, strangely enough. Vimes had never quite known why, but the city seemed to be rather ashamed of the general. One reason, of course, was that he'd ended up fighting Ankh-Morpork. The city of Genua had run out of royalty, inbreeding having progressed to the point where the sole remaining example consisted mostly of teeth, and senior courtiers had written to Ankh-Morpork asking for help. There'd been a lot of that sort of thing, Vimes had been surprised to learn. The little kingdoms of the Stow Plains were forever scrounging spare royalty off one another. The king had sent Tacticus out of sheer exasperation. It's hard to run a proper empire when you're constantly getting blood-stained letters on the lines of, "Dear Sire, I beg to inform you that we have conquered Betrek, Smail, and Ushistan. Please send Ankh-Morpokian dollars 20,000 back pay." The man never knew when to stop. So he was hastily made a duke and packed off to Genua, whereupon his first action was to consider what was the city's greatest military threat, and then, having identified it, to declare war on Ankh-Morpork. But what else had anyone expected? He'd done his duty. He'd brought back heaps of spoils, lots of captives, and almost uniquely among Ankh-Morpork's military leaders, most of his men. Vimes suspected that this last fact was one reason why history didn't approve. There was a suggestion that this was in some way not playing fair. Veni, vidi, vici. That was what the man was supposed to have said when he'd conquered, where, Pseudopolis, wasn't it? Or Al-Khali, or Quirm? Maybe Stolat? That was in the old days when you attacked anyone else's city on principle, and went back and did them over again if they looked like getting up. And in those days you didn't care if the world watched. You wanted them to watch, and learn. Veni, vidi, vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. As a comment, it always struck Vimes as a bit too pat. It wasn't the sort of thing that you came up with on the spur of the moment, was it? It sounded as if he'd worked it out. He'd probably spent long evenings in his tent, looking up in the dictionary short words beginning with V, and trying them out. Veni, vermini, vomui. I came, I got ratted, I threw up. Visi, venere, vermusi. I visited, I caught an embarrassing disease, I ran away. It must have been a big relief to come up with three short, acceptable words. He probably made them up first, and then went off to see somewhere and conquer it. He opened the book at random. "It is always useful to face an enemy who is prepared to die for his country," he read. "This means that both you and he have exactly the same aim in mind." "Huh." "Bingley, bingley, bingley, beep." Vimes's hands slammed down on the box. "Yes, what is it?"
3:05 p.m. Interview with Corporal Littlebottom, missing Sergeant Colon," said the demon sulkily.
"I never arranged anything like..." "Who told you? Are you telling me that I've got an appointment and I don't know about it?"
"That's right."
"So how do you know about it?"
"You told me to know about it last night," said the demon.
"You can tell me about appointments I don't know about," said Vimes.
"There's still appointments, sine qua appointments," said the demon. "They exist, as it were, in appointment phase space."
"What the hell does that mean?"
"Look," said the demon patiently, "you can have an appointment at any time, right? So therefore any appointment exists in potentia."
"Where's that?"
"Any particular appointment simply collapses the waveform," said the demon. I merely select the most likely one from the projected matrix.
You're just making this up, said Vimes. If you were right, then any second now. Someone knocked at the door.
It was a polite, tentative tap. Vimes didn't take his eyes off the smirking demon.
Is that you, Corporal Littlebottom? He said.
Yes, sir. Sergeant Colon has sent a pigeon. I thought you ought to see it, sir.
Come in.
A small roll of thin paper was placed on his desk. He read, Have volunteered for a mission of vital importance. Nobby is here also. There will be statues of us when this day's work is over. P.S. Someone I can't tell you who says this note will self-destruct in 5 seconds. He is sorry he hasn't got good chemicals to do it better. The paper began to crinkle around the edges and then vanished in a small puff of acrid smoke. Vimes stared at the little pile of ash that remained.
I suppose it's a mercy they didn't blow up the pigeon, sir, said Cheery.
What the hell are they up to? Well, I can't chase around after them. Thanks, Cheery.
The dwarf saluted and departed.
Coincidence, said Vimes.
All right, then, said the demon. Bingley, 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 beep. 3:15 p.m. Emergency meeting with Captain Carrot.
It was a cylinder, tapering to a point at both ends. At one end, the taper was quite complex, the cylinder narrowing in a succession of smaller and smaller rings, overlapping one another until they ended in a large fishtail. Oiled leather could be seen gleaming in the gaps between the metal. At the other end, extending from the cylinder for all the world like a horn of a unicorn, was a very long and pointed screw thread. The whole thing was mounted on a crude trolley, which was in turn riding on a pair of iron rails that disappeared into the black water at the far end of the boathouse.
Looks like a giant fish to me, said Colon, made of tin.
With an awn, said Nobby.
It'll never float, said Colon. I can see where you've gone wrong there. Everyone knows metal sinks.
Not entirely true, said Leonard, diplomatically. In any case, this boat is designed to sink.
What?
Propulsion was a major headache, I'm afraid, said Leonard, climbing up a stepladder. I thought of paddles and oars and even some kind of screw, and then I thought, dolphins. That's the ticket. They move extremely fast with barely an effort. That's out at sea, of course. We only get the shovel-nosed dolphin in our estuary here. The linkage rods are a bit complicated, but I used to be able to get quite a turn of speed. The pedalling can be somewhat tiresome, but with 3 of us we should be able to get up some quite satisfactory accelerations. It's amazing what you can do when you imitate nature. I just wish my flying
Oh, where did you go?
It would be difficult to establish what part of satisfactorily accelerating nature the watchmen were trying to imitate, but it was a part which tended to get stuck indoors a lot. They stopped struggling and began to back into the room.
Ah, Sergeant, said Lord Vetinari, entering in front of them. And Corporal Nobbs, too. Leonard has explained everything to you?
You can't ask us to go in that thing, sir. It'll be suicide, said Colon.
The patrician brought his hands together in front of his lips in the manner of someone praying, and sucked air thoughtfully.
No, no. I think you are wrong, he said at last, as if reaching a conclusion on some complex metaphysical conundrum. I think that in all probability, going into that thing would be a valiant and possibly rewarding deed. I would venture to suggest that in fact it is not going that would be suicidal. But I would appreciate your views.
Lord Vetinari was not a heavily built man, and these days he walked with the aid of an ebony cane. No one could remember seeing him handle a weapon, and a flash of unaccustomed insight told Sergeant Colon that this was not in fact a comforting thought at all. They said he'd been educated at the Assassin's School, but no one remembered what weapons he'd learned. He'd studied languages, and suddenly, with him in front of you, this didn't seem like the soft option. Sergeant Colon saluted, always a useful thing to do in an emergency such as this, and shouted,
Corporal Nobbs, why aren't you in the metal sinking fish thing?
Sarge, let's see you get up them steps, lad. Hup, hup, hup.
Nobby scrambled up the ladder and disappeared. Colon saluted again. You could usually tell his nervousness by the smartness of his salute. You could have cut bread with this one.
Ready to go, sir,
he shouted.
Well done, Sergeant.
said Vetinari. You're displaying exactly those special qualities I'm looking for.
Here, Sarge,
came a metallic voice from the belly of the fish.
There's all chains and cogwheels in here. What's this do?
The big auger in front of the thing started to squeak around. Leonard appeared from behind the fish.
I think we should all get in, he said. I've lit the candle that'll burn down and sever the string that'll release the weight that'll pull the blocks out.
What's this thing called?
Said Colan as he followed the patrician up the ladder.
Well, because it is submersed in a marine environment, I've always called it the going under the water safely device, said Leonard behind him. But usually I just think of it as the boat.
Thinking up good names was, oddly enough, one area where Leonard of Querm's genius tended to give up. He reached behind him and shut the lid. After a moment, any listener in the boathouse would have heard a complicated plonk as bolts slid into place. The candle burned down and severed the string that released the weight that pulled the blocks out, and slowly at first the boat slid down the rails and into the dark water, which after a second or two closed over it with a gloop. No one took any notice of Angua as she trotted up the gangplank. The important thing she knew was to look at home. No one bothered a large dog that looked as though it knew where it was going. People were milling about on the deck in the manner peculiar to non-sailors on board ship, not sure of what they should be doing or where they should refrain from doing it. Some of the more stoic ones had made little camps, defining with bundles and pieces of cloth tiny areas of private property. They reminded Angua of the bicoloured drainpipes and microscopically delineated household boundaries in Moneytrap Lane, showing yet another way of drawing a line in the sand. This is mine, and that is yours. Trespass on mine, and you'll get yours. There were a couple of guards standing on either side of the door to the cabins. They hadn't been told to stop dogs. Scents led down below. She could smell the other dogs and a strong odour of cloves. At the end of the narrow passage, a door was ajar. She forced it open with her nose and looked around. The dogs were lying on a rug on one side of a large cabin. Other dogs might have barked, but these just turned their beautiful heads towards her, sighted down the length of their noses, and examined her carefully. A narrow bed beyond them was half concealed by silk hangings. 71-hour Ahmed was bending over it, but he turned when she entered. He glanced towards the dogs and gave her a puzzled look. Then, to her amazement, he sat down on the deck in front of her.
"And who do you belong to?"
he said in perfect Morporkian. Angua wagged her tail. There was someone in the bed. She could smell them, but they wouldn't be a problem. Jaw muscles strong enough to sever someone's neck help you to feel relaxed in most situations. Ahmed patted her on the head. Very few people have ever done that to a werewolf without having to get people to cut up their meals for them in future. But Angua had learned self-control. Then he stood up and went to the door. She heard him say something to someone outside, and then he came back into the room and smiled at her.
"I go, I come back."
He opened a small cupboard and took out a jeweled dog collar.
"You shall have a collar. Oh, and here is some food," he added, as a servant brought in some bowls. "Knick-knack, paddywhack, give a dog a bone," is a rhyme I hear your Ankh Morpork children sing. But a paddywhack is a ball of gristle suitable only for animal food, and who knows what part of the animal is its knick-knack.
The plate was put in front of Angua. The other dogs stirred, but Ahmed snapped a word at them, and they settled back again. The food was dog food. In Ankh Morpork terms, it meant something that you wouldn't even put in a sausage, and there are very few things that a man with a big enough mincer cannot put in a sausage. The little central human part of her was revolted, but the werewolf drooled at the sight of every glistening tube and wobbly fat bit. It was on a silver plate. She looked up. Ahmed was watching her carefully. Of course, the royal dogs were treated like kings, all those diamond collars. Didn't have to mean he knew.
"Not hungry?" he said. "Your mouth says you are."
Something snapped around her neck as she spun around to bite. Her teeth closed on a mouthful of greasy cloth, but that wasn't as important as the pain.
"His Highness has always liked fine collars on his dogs," said 71-hour Ahmed through the red mist. "Rubies, emeralds, and diamonds, Miss angua. His face came down level with hers. Set in silver. A crucial factor, I have always found, is not the size of the forces. It is the positioning and commitment of reserves, the bringing of power to a point. Vimes tried to concentrate on Tacticus, but there were two distractions. One was that the grinning face of 71-hour Achmed looked out at him from every line. The other was his watch, which he had propped up against the disorganizer. It was powered by actual clockwork and was much more reliable, and it never needed feeding. It ticked quietly. As far as it was concerned, he could forget his appointments. He liked it.
The second hand was just curving towards the top of the minute when he heard someone coming up the stairs.
"Come in, Captain," said Vimes. There was a snigger from the box.
Carrot's face was pinker than normal.
"Something's happened to Angua," said Vimes.
The high colour drained from Carrot's face.
"How did you know that?"
Vimes firmly closed the lid on the sniggering demon.
"Let's call it intuition, shall we? I'm right, am I?"
"Yes, sir. She went aboard a Clatchian boat, and now it's sailing. She hasn't come off."
"What the hell did she go on board for?"
"We were after Achmed, and he looked as if he was taking someone with him, sir. Someone ill, sir."
"He's left? But the diplomats are still..."
Vimes stopped. There was, if you didn't know Carrot, something wrong with the situation. There were people who, when their girlfriend was spirited away on a foreign ship, would have dived into the Ankh, or at least run briskly along the crust, leapt aboard and dealt out merry hell on a democratic basis. Of course, at a time like this, that would be a dumb thing to do. The sensible approach would be to let people know, but even so... But Carrot really did believe that personal wasn't the same as important. Of course, Vimes believed the same thing. You had to hope that when push came to shove, you'd act the right way, but there was something slightly creepy about someone who didn't just believe it, but lived their life by it. It was as unnerving as meeting a really poor priest. Obviously, it was a consideration that if someone had captured Angua, you knew that the rescue you were going to probably wouldn't be hers. But the gods alone knew what would happen if he left now. The city had gone war mad. Big things were happening. At a time like this, every cell in his body was telling him that the commander of the watch had responsibilities. He drummed his fingers on the desk. In times like this, it was vital to make the right decision. That was what he was paid for. Responsibility. He ought to stay here and do the best he could. But history was full of the bones of good men who'd followed bad orders in the hope that they could soften the blow. Oh yes, there were worse things they could do, but most of them began right where they started following bad orders. His eyes went from Carrot to the disorganizer, and then to the tottering mounds of paperwork on his desk.
Blow that! He was a thief-taker. He'd always be a thief-taker. Why lie? "Damned if I'll let Achmed get back to Clatch," he said, standing up. "Fast boat, was it?"
"Yes, but it looked pretty heavy in the water. Then maybe we can catch it up before it goes very far."
As he hurried forward, he had just for a second the strange sensation that he was two people. And this was because for the merest fraction of a second he was two people. They were both called Samuel Vimes. To history, choices are merely directions. The trousers of time opened up, and Vimes began to hurtle down one leg of them. And somewhere else, the Vimes who made a different choice began to drop into a different future. They both darted back to grab their disorganizers. By the most outrageous of freak chances, quite uniquely, in this split second of decision, they each got the wrong one. And sometimes the avalanche depends on one snowflake. Sometimes a pebble is allowed to find out what might have happened, if only it had bounced the other way. The wizards of Ankh Morpork had been very firm on the subject of printing.
"It's not happening here," they said. "Supposing," they said, "someone printed a book on magic and then broke up the type again and used it for a book on, say, cookery. The metal would remember."
"Spells aren't just words. They have extra dimensions of existence.
We'd be up to here in talking soothlays. Besides, someone might print thousands of the damn things, many of which could well be read by unsuitable people."
The Engravers Guild was also against printing. There was something pure, they said, about an engraved page of text. It was there, whole, unsullied. Their members could do very fine work at very reasonable rates. Allowing unskilled people to bash lumps of type together showed a disrespect for words, and no good would come of it. The only attempt ever to set up a printing press in Ankh-Morpork had ended in a mysterious fire and the death by suicide of the luckless printer. Everyone knew it was suicide because he'd left a note. The fact that this had been engraved on the head of a pin was considered an irrelevant detail. And the patrician was against printing because if people knew too much, it would only bother them. So people relied on word of mouth, which worked very well because the mouths were so close together. A lot of them were just below the noses of the members of the Beggars Guild, citizens generally regarded as reasonably reliable and well-informed, except in the particular case of Sidney Lopsides, who was paid $2 a day from city funds to wear a sack over his head. It wasn't that he was spectacularly deformed as such, it was merely that anyone who saw him spent the rest of the day with an unnerving feeling that they were upside down. Some of them were highly thought of for their sports coverage. Lord Rust looked thoughtfully at Cumbling Michael, a grade two mutterer. "And what happened next?" Cumbling Michael scratched his wrist. He'd recently got his extra grade because he'd finally managed to catch a disfiguring but harmless skin disease.
"Mr. Carrot was in there about 2 minutes, my lord. Then they all come running out, right, and they..."
"Who were they?" said Rust. He fought off an urge to scratch his own arm.
"There was Carrot and Vimes and a dwarf and a zombie and all of them, my lord. They ran all the way to the docks, my lord, and Vimes saw Captain Jenkins, and he said..."
"Ah, Captain Jenkins, this is your lucky day."
The captain looked up from the rope he was coiling. No one likes being told it's their lucky day. That sort of thing does not bode well. When someone tells you it's your lucky day, something bad is about to happen.
"It is?" he said. "Yes, because you have an unrivaled opportunity to aid the war effort."
"I have?"
"And also to demonstrate your patriotism," Carrot added.
"I do?" "We need to borrow your boat," said Vimes. "Bugger off." "I'm choosing to believe that was a salty nautical expression meaning why certainly," said Vimes. "Captain Carrot?"
"Sir?"
"You and Detritus go and look behind that false partition in the hold," said Vimes.
"Right, sir," said Carrot, walking towards the ladder.
"There's no false partition in the hold," snapped Jenkins, "and I know the law, and you can't..."
There was a crash of timber from below.
"If that wasn't a false partition, our Carrot's gone and knocked a hole in the side," said Vimes calmly, watching the captain.
"I know the law too," said Vimes. He drew his sword.
"See this," he said, holding it up. "This is military law, and military law is a sword, not a two-edged sword. There's only one edge, and it's pointing at you. Found anything, Carrot?"
Carrot appeared over the edge of the hold. There was a crossbow in his hand.
"I do declare," said Vimes, "but that looks to me like a burly and strong-in-the-arm Viper Mark III, which kills people but leaves buildings standing."
"There's crates and crates of stuff," said Carrot.
"There's no law,"
Jenkins began, but he sounded as if the bottom was dropping out of his world.
"You know, I think there probably is some law against selling weapons to the enemy in times of war," said Vimes. "Of course, there might not be. Tell you what," he added brightly, "why don't we all go along to Sartor Square? It's full of people around this time, all very keen on the war and cheering our brave lads. Why don't we go along and put it to them? You told me I ought to listen to the voice of the people. Odd thing, ain't it? You meet people one at a time, they seem decent, they got brains that work, and then they get together and you hear the voice of the people and it snarls. That's mob rule."
"Oh, no, surely not," said Vimes. "Call it democratic justice."
"One man, one rock," Detritus volunteered.
Jenkins looked like a man afraid the world was about to drop out of his bottom. He glared at Vimes and then at Carrot and saw no help there.
"Of course, you'd have nothing to fear from us," said Vimes, "although you might trip on your way down the stairs to the cells."
"There's no stairs down to your cells.
Stairs can be arranged."
"Please, Mr. Jenkins," said Carrot, the good cop.
"I wasn't taking the weapons to Clatch,"
Jenkins said slowly, as if he was reading the words very painfully off some interior script.
"I had, in fact, bought them to donate them to..."
"Yes.
Yes," said Vimes.
"Our brave lads," said Jenkins.
"Well done," said Carrot.
"And you'd be happy to..."
Vimes prompted.
"And I'd be happy to lend my boat to the war effort," said Jenkins, sweating.
A true patriot, said Vimes. Jenkins writhed. Who told you there was a false panel in the hold? He demanded. It was a guess, right? Right, said Vimes. Aha! I knew you were only guessing. Patriotic and clever, said Vimes. Now, how'd you make this thing go fast?
Lord Rust tapped his fingers on the table.
What did he take the boat for?
Dunno, my lord,
said Cumbling Michael, scratching his head.
Damn! Did anyone else see them?
Oh, there weren't many people around, my lord.
That's a small mercy, at least.
Just me and foul old Ron and the Duckman and Blind Hugh and Ringo Eyebrows and No Way Jose and Sidney Lopsides and that bastard Stooley and Whistling Dick and a few others, my lord.
Rust sank back in his chair and put a pale hand over his face. In Ankh-Morpork, the night had 1,000 eyes, and so did the day, and it also had 500 mouths and 999 ears. Sidney Lopsides again.
The Clatchians must know, then, he said. A detachment of Ankh-Morpork soldiery has taken ship for Clatch, an invasion force.
Oh, you could hardly call it, Lieutenant Hornet began.
The Clatchians will call it that. Besides, the troll Detritus is with them, said Rust.
Hornet looked glum. Detritus was an invasion force all by himself.
What ships have we commandeered? Said Rust.
There's more than 20 now, if you include the Indestructible, the Indolence, and the... Lieutenant Hornet looked at his list again. And the Prid of Ankh-Morpork, sir.
The Prid?
I'm afraid so, sir.
We should be able to take more than 1,000 men and 200 horses, then.
Why not let Vimes go? Said Lord Salachi. Let the Clatchians deal with him, and good riddance.
And give them a victory over Ankh-Morpork forces? That's how they will see it, damn the man. He forces our hand, but still, perhaps it is for the best. We should embark.
Are we entirely ready, sir? Said Lieutenant Hornet, with the special inflection that means, we are not entirely ready, sir.
We had better be. Glory awaits, gentlemen. In the words of General Tacticus, let us take history by the scrotum. Of course, he was not a very honourable fighter.
White sunlight etched dark shadows in Prince Kadram's palace. He, too, had a map of Clatch, made of tiny coloured tiles set into the floor. He sat looking at it pensively.
Just one boat, he said.
General Ashal, his chief advisor, nodded, and added,
Our scryers can't get a very clear picture over that distance, but we do believe one of the men to be Vimes. You recall the name, sire?
Ah, the useful Commander Vimes, the prince smiled.
Indeed, and since then there has been a lot of activity all along the docks. We have to take the view that the expeditionary force is setting out.
I thought we had at least a week, Ashal.
It is certainly puzzling. They cannot possibly be prepared, sire. Something must have happened.
Kadram sighed.
Oh, well, let us follow where fate points the way. Where will they attack?
Gebra, sire. I'm sure of it.
Our most heavily fortified city? Surely not. Only an idiot would do that.
I have studied Lord Rust in some depth, sire. Remember that he doesn't expect us to fight, so the size of our forces really doesn't worry him.
The general smiled. It was a neat, thin little smile.
And, of course, in attacking us, he is piling infamy upon infamy. The other coastal states will take note.
A change of plan, then, said Kadram. Ankh-Morpork can wait.
A wise move, sire, as always.
Any news of my poor brother?
Alas, no, sire.
Our agents must search harder. The world is watching, Ashal.
Correct, sire.